This is Deborah Roberts, co-anchor of 2020. You're about to hear episode 2 of Wild Crime, Murder in the Rocky Mountains. It's a true crime series from ABC Studios that grew out of our work here at 2020. Here's episode 2, The First Wife.
Wild places. Wilder crimes. These are the stories of the elite team that solves them in the most dangerous crime scenes in the world, our national parks.
A man having one wife die is tragic. A man having two wives die is suspicious.
He could see that the vehicle had dropped and was laying on his wife.
We all had that kind of sick feeling that not only did he kill Tony, but that would mean that he killed Lynn too.
There's no way that that was an accident.
Was she his lover?
Oh my gosh! How have I not seen through this guy?
Harold's story was that they were coming up on their 12th year anniversary, and he was planning a surprise for Tony, and they decided to hike Deer Mountain.
It's not something that you would want to do on supposedly your anniversary, go on this extreme hike. That didn't make sense to us.
When you get to the scene, you realize the only reason to be where you are is to commit murder. It's a moment where you're absolutely sure that this person killed this woman. Pretty quickly after Ranger Faraday's first and only interview with Harold, we found out that Harold had retained a criminal attorney, which basically precluded us interviewing Harold again. And so to get information about Harold, we started doing interviews with everybody. I talked to the Bertolets several times. While they believe that Harold might be responsible for the death of Tony, they maintain contact with Harold to keep an eye on Haley. They wanted to make sure Haley was okay. But they also giving me updates on Harold, and they felt that that was a way that they could help in the investigation. We talked to the nannies, and they were able to tell us some things about the house. One of the nannies told us that Harold and Tony didn't sleep together, that they had separate areas where they slept. He had an office in his basement, but occasionally he would also go on business trips. And he would go on these trips, but he wouldn't have luggage, and then he would just kind of show up the next day. And the nanny was wondering if Harold was having an affair. He seemed to have a secret life. So, all right, let's find out what we can about his business.
Now, the address for the business was in his basement. But if you talk to him, he would say, I've got 10 to 12 managers reporting to me daily. I've got 90 employees working all over the country.
We thought there was plenty of money. He always portrayed himself as a wealthy person. And we were getting word that they were needing money. I do remember that Mr. and Ms. Bertolet were confused why the money seemed to be missing.
My parents are buying the house, they're buying the car, they're paying for the tuition. That doesn't make sense.
We couldn't find any concrete evidence of his work.
There was no online presence, and almost everybody has an online presence of some sort if they have a business, especially if you're a fundraiser. All businesses need to be registered with the Secretary of State. So I was able to determine that Resource Development Services was not registered in Colorado. But also, on his business cards, Harold had CFR, Certified Fundraiser. And there is actually an agency that issues that certification. So I contacted that agency, and they indicated, no, we have no idea who he is, and no, he's not a certified fundraiser. Oh my gosh, he doesn't even have a business. And then we received a letter about his first wife. Her name was Lynn Henthorne.
Most people didn't know that Harold was married before and that his first wife had died.
Harold's first wife, Lynn Henthorne, described as a very beautiful, loving Christian woman, but tragically died in an accident, deemed an accident at that time in 1995.
What Harold tells most people is Glenn died in a car accident. And most people aren't gonna press. But I think what Harold says about how she died was completely dependent on what he thought he could get away with.
Harold said that his first wife died in a car accident, and he doesn't say much more than that.
We didn't get much information out of how Lynn died. You know, he was very, very short on a lot of details.
We got told she had cancer, and we got told it was a car accident, so you got told different stories. So we didn't know.
But I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is two wives for Harold that have died now.
In the aftermath of Tony's death, anonymous letters and phone calls and warnings start going out to a number of people.
Because we had some suspicions that Tony's death was not as Harold was making it sound, I made the phone call to the Larimer County Sheriff's Office. I did do it anonymously, and other people had done the same thing.
The coroner in charge of Tony's autopsy, an investigative reporter at a TV station in Denver, the FBI, National Park Service, were on the receiving end of what ended up being 17 anonymous letters.
The consistent theme was Harold's first wife died in similar, unusual circumstances. You gotta look into it. Remote locations, odd places, why were they there in the first place? Harold was not injured in any way in either of these incidents, but his spouse was killed.
Getting these types of anonymous calls and anonymous letters is unusual. That hasn't happened to me before. I've done about 8,000 cases now. To whom it may concern, Mr. Henthorne lost his first wife about 17 years ago after a suspicious accident in a remote location. Sadly, there are many similarities in these two cases. It took me 3 months to get enough of the investigative details together that I felt comfortable filing the death certificate, and I filed it as undetermined. Homicide cannot be entirely excluded. I've never written that kind of a comment before.
We needed to build a history of Harold. So our strategy was to start looking at Lynn Henthorne's death.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So we're in where Harold and Lynn Henthorne lived. In the early 90s, in Centennial, Colorado. Harold lived here up until he actually married Tony. Hearing that Harold Henthorne had a first wife, Lynn, that died in suspicious circumstances, we wanted to get in as much information as we could about that. Harold and Lynn got married in 1984. And then she passed away in 1995. And what people told us about their marriage is Lynn's a very sweet, loving woman, very religious, and nothing really hugely negative about Harold, except for it did come out that he was controlling of her.
My name is Kim LaFerrier. Lynn was my best friend. And I would definitely say that I was her best friend. Lynn told me that she had met somebody very special at a wedding, and that she was very, very interested in him. And she told me his name is Harold. And she said, I think you're really gonna like him. He's a great guy. And he really seems to care about me.
What are your memories from that day? Was she happy?
She was, oh yeah. She was beaming.
I seem to remember that.
Lynn was, she was truly a gem. She was definitely the most sensitive and loving sister. And she was also very timid in some regards and skittish. Gosh, there's just so many ways to try and describe her. I feel like she was a Christian. I feel like the light of God shined through her.
As a child, she was sugar and spice and a little fireball at the same time. She was an organizer, and she was very competitive in sports. She played field hockey. She was a cheerleader. She wore her emotions on her sleeve.
Actually, leading up to the rehearsal dinner, I did not know Harold very well.
Did you? Did you, any of us feel like we knew
him? Not really well.
My first impressions of Harold was he was an outgoing, gregarious salesman type. And I'm being a salesman myself at that time. I was fine with that energy.
Harold is bigger than life. He smiles all the time. He laughs all the time. So when I first met him, I thought, gosh, this is a great guy. This guy seems wonderful. He was hugging Lynn all the time and very touchy with her and smiling and just made you feel warm.
When we were moving quickly towards Lynn's and Harold's wedding, it was clear that Harold was in charge. I found it strange that Harold had binders and binders. One binder devoted to finding a photographer. One binder devoted to the reception. One binder to the outfits they were going to wear.
The flowers,
The flowers. And he had Lynn doing research on all of these areas and filling in the binders with information so they could make the best choice. I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, why?
So Lynn and Harold got married, but then almost immediately, Harold was saying, we need to move to Colorado. So he takes her away.
We did visit the Inglewood home, and I didn't notice anything about their relationship at that time. We had a blast. I mean, we had so much fun going up into the Rocky Mountains, and I thought everything was great.
But then, over time, it seemed like she became quieter and Harold became louder. We began to see more of this controlling behavior.
I remember I called Lynn one day and I said, can we talk? You know, this was a good time for me. And she said, no, can you call back later when Harold's here? And I said, well, you know, can't we just talk? And she said, as a couple, we've decided that whenever we talk to family, we want to both be on the phone at the same time.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, again, that's so weird. That's so controlling. Mm-hmm.
Lynn always felt like she had to honor Harold. It was back in the time where a lot of Christian women were taught that the husband was the head of the house and that anything they said, you know, they had the final word there. And so she didn't ever buck him. She didn't ever question what he was saying.
Harold came to work many times. The first time I met him, he came into work. My first impression of Harold was almost immediately to want to take a step back. I felt him to be overbearing. As Lynn talked about her relationship with her husband and some of her personal life, it didn't always gel with the same Lynn we saw. Lynn was not a pushover.
Harold was early on complaining about back issues, and Lynn was always having to serve him in some way. It always seemed like he was lying on his back for 2 weeks, and she was trying to work and take care of him.
Lynn was diagnosed, I believe it's rheumatoid arthritis, and she was in quite a lot of pain. And she took medication, and the medication became a concern. She wanted to make certain that it wasn't doing anything to interfere with her ability to get pregnant or to have a child. There was pressure from Harold. She spoke often about how much Harold wanted her to have a child. I felt that that was the first time I got some indication that she was not comfortable with Harold right then.
She confided in me, and she said, "Grace, I don't know what to do. Like, we're having some marital issues, but he doesn't want me to talk to anyone. He would consider that disloyal." And she didn't know where to go, like what to do. She wanted that to be a private thing, for me not to say anything to Harold. So I just said, which I feel so awful for now, you know, I'll pray. I'll pray for you. I'm so sorry you're going through that.
I think when Tony died, we all had that feeling that...
Sort of sick.
Kind of sick feeling that he...
Oh my gosh.
He did it. He, and not only did he kill Tony, but that,
that would mean
that he killed Lynn too.
Mm-hmm. Someone driving past on this dark, deserted road sees Harold and Lynn's Jeep, and they do see Lynn, and she does look scared.
I remember sitting up in bed thinking, no one changes a tire like that. Nobody changes a tire the way he said he changed the tire. Oh, that's not right.
It's hard to know when an investigation picks up speed, but in the case of Tony and Lynn's deaths, there's an overwhelming number of people voicing their suspicions as loudly as they can to anybody who will listen. It was a tidal wave of people who'd been involved in Harold or Tony or Lynn or all three of their lives who finally sort of snapped. More than a dozen said something isn't right. And not only said it, but went so far as to take specific action to make sure it was investigated.
My name is Laura Thomas. I was coroner in Douglas County, Colorado. In 2012, I was here at my house on a Sunday afternoon when someone was banging on my front door. So I went to the front door and I saw a gentleman who I knew from the neighborhood from seeing him walk around. And he says to me, "Hey, aren't you the coroner?" And I said, "Yes, I am the coroner." He told me that he belonged to Cherry Hills Community Church and that Tony Henthorne, who belonged to that church, who died in a strange fall in Rocky Mountain National Park. And I told him, well, Rocky Mountain National Park isn't in Douglas County. But he said, this guy's first wife died in Douglas County many years ago. And he proceeded to tell me the story about Harold Henthorne and that people at the church had always thought that Harold was a little strange. And there were a lot of stories going around the church about Harold's first wife who had died in some kind of a car accident. The next morning, I went to the sheriff's office and asked if I could get the case for this death. And they looked it up and they said, "Oh, that's a closed case. We'll print it for you." So I came home that night, I settled here in my office with my highlighters, and I started reading this case and highlighting all the things in it that were interesting of some way to me. And by the time I was done reading that case file, I thought, I agree with my neighbor. Something here isn't right. Harold claims that he was driving the road and the right front tire seemed spongy. So he pulled over on this dirt side of the road and he decided to change the tire. And he said he got the Jeep jack out and went to put it under the right front wheel well and realized the jack didn't work. So he put that jack back but he happened to have two boat jacks in the back of the Jeep, and he used the boat jacks to jack up the vehicle.
Well, there's two types of jacks involved in this incident. One is a regular car jack. The other jack was a boat jack, which is basically a tube with another telescoping tube that comes out of it. Not safe for a car. His story is that this car jack, this more stable one, didn't work, so he used a boat jack to jack up the car.
So then he said he had taken the lug nuts off of the wheel, and he said that Lynn had a cloth in her hand, and he handed her the lug nuts. He pulled the tire off, and then he said he went to the back of the Jeep and he tossed the tire into the back of the Jeep, and that when he did that, it dislodged the Jeep, and he heard a scream, and he said he ran to the front of the vehicle and he could see that the vehicle had dropped and was laying on his wife.
There's Lynn trapped under the rotor, the brake rotor, because he hadn't put the other tire back on yet. His version was that Lynn must have dropped the lug nuts and gone to crawl under the car to get the lug nuts, because there were lug nuts in the photos of the scene. There were lug nuts under the car. One of the questions we had was actually, how did Lynn get under that rotor? Because when you jack up a car, you do it only to the degree that you're able to pull the tire off to replace the tire. And that space is not that great. And again, to get under a rotor and to eventually get crushed by it is very unusual.
There are multiple eyewitnesses to the aftermath of the accident that killed Lynn.
We could see, you know, some legs coming out from the bottom of the car. And her husband came over and he started screaming at us, "Don't touch her, leave her alone."
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
We felt that our investigation wasn't into the homicide of Lynn Henthorne. Our investigation was into the death of Lynn Henthorne. Douglas County's investigation was into the homicide of Lynn Henthorne. At the end of the day, we couldn't prosecute that case, but we wanted to learn as much as we could.
I'm Dave Weaver, Douglas County Sheriff's Office. I got a call from Beth Schott asking us to look into the death of Lynn Henthorne. And this coincided with the death of Toni Henthorne, who was Harold Henthorne's second wife. There were some suspicions that both wives had died in an isolated location under questionable circumstances. I was given the Lynn Henthorne case to reinvestigate in January of 2013. Getting a case that old, 18 years old, I had to sit down and analyze what was available to me. Who are the witnesses I should talk to? Are they available? How can I find them? And then would they have information that had not been previously known? Well, Dwight DeVries, when I interviewed him, stopped to offer assistance. Harold was standing outside the car. Lynn was still in the car. Dwight described to me that Lynn had a frightened look on her face. He also said that Harold just wanted him out of there. So Dwight said, "Well, if you don't want me to help you change the tire, you want me to park here so I can illuminate the area for you?" Harold was insistent, "I don't need your help. Essentially, get out of here. In other words, leave me alone." Then I discovered in the documentation, one of the first witnesses on scene, when I called her up, just out of the blue, I said, "Hello, I'm Detective Dave Weaver, Douglas County Sheriff's Office." And I said, "Can you think of any reason why a detective from Douglas County would want to call you and talk to you?" And her response to me was, "That lady from on the mountain, I still have nightmares about that."
It was on a Saturday night. We went around a curve and there's a man standing in the middle of the road with a flasher. We pulled over and he told us that there was an accident, that they had a flat and his wife got stuck under the car. We looked at each other and we could see, you know, some legs, you know, coming out from the bottom of the car. We all got out of the truck and we got her out of the car from underneath the car. And we were gently turning her over because she was on her stomach. We're doing the CPR and her husband came over and he started screaming at us, "Don't touch her, leave her alone. What the F are you doing? Get the F away from her." At that point, she's turning blue. Her husband, he had a nice coat on and he didn't take his coat off to cover like we did. You could hear the sirens coming. And that's when the guys started asking him, "How did she get underneath that car?" And he replied, "Well, there's a lug nut that rolled under there. She must have been going to get it." What kind of dumbass would let his wife go underneath that car for a lug nut? You don't need one lug nut. And when he heard the sirens coming, the look on his face was like in a panic, more of a panic, instead of gladness, you know, that there's help coming for my wife. It was creepier than ever. There's no way that that was an accident.
As I was doing the case investigation, three things kind of struck me as, is this possible? Why would Lynn be in that position to begin with? That was number one. Number two is, could I get the Jeep to fall off the jacks the way they had to have fallen off, the way that Harold had described it? And the third thing is, lug nuts aren't round. They don't roll.
Did it happen the way Harold said it happened? Because it's a very bizarre sequence of events, especially for a man who's so obsessed with safety, as allegedly Harold was, to jack this car up using an unsafe jack and then try to change a tire.
Douglas County recreated the events as described by Harold for the investigation. Let's try this now. Okay. Nothing. So let me put a little pressure this way. Nothing.
You can't replicate it the way he says it happened.
We were trying to pull in elements of Lynn's death into our case. When Dave Weaver was assigned to the case, he opened it up as a possible homicide, and he was looking at it as, is that even physically possible for someone to crawl under a car to get lug nuts and then have this jack collapse?
Laura Thomas is the coroner in Douglas County, and she has a lot of questions about Lynn's death. So much so that she hires someone to reconstruct the accident that took Lynn.
After I went through this whole case, I called Arnie Wheat. He came to Douglas County and drove around and looked at the scene to get a better feel for what had happened.
My name is Arnold Wheat. Laura asked us to look at this particular death investigation from the perspective of a traffic accident reconstructionist. Accident reconstruction is sort of like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. You take the pieces of information and factual information and try to put them together to see if they fit to form a more complete picture of what happened. Where was the vehicle positioned? What's the terrain look like? You look at the gravel surface that this Jeep was parked on. There was a grade going uphill from the rear towards the front of the vehicle. Why would lug nuts roll uphill on a gravel surface?
So, let's go ahead and take that tire off. So based on the crime scene investigation, we're going to replicate with this exemplar vehicle the layout of all the physical evidence. That includes the lug nuts, the positioning of the bottle jacks, and then hopefully also replicate the vehicle's movement off of the bottle jacks. It'd be, yeah, there you go.
Is that about right?
Yeah. So one of the versions the Herald gave, Lynn's here 6 feet away from the Jeep. He takes the tire, he walks to the back, puts the tire in the back. Whatever he did caused the Jeep to fall off the jack.
But look at the time interval. From the time he picks up the flat tire, goes roughly 12 feet to the back corner.
Yes.
To put the tire in, she moves closer to the vehicle, then drops the lug nuts, allegedly, and then gets down on her stomach and crawls up underneath. So, I mean, that timing just doesn't make sense because it would take more time, I believe, for her to do all of those activities than it would for him to come around and put the tire in the back of the Jeep.
No logical person would crawl under a rotor that's jacked up.
Especially with her having arthritis.
Right.
The other inconsistency is both the medical people as well as the coroner's office, when they did the autopsy, there was nothing in her fingernails, there was nothing on her hands indicating that she was struggling. You would think if she was laying on her stomach and had an axle drop on her back, that she may have clawed her way or tried to move.
Even if you know nothing about cars and changing tires, I don't know anybody who would put basically a weapon right above their back. And I've changed many a tire, and I've had many a bad back. So if I was Harold, who allegedly had a bad back, you wouldn't just pick the tire up and throw it in. But that's what he said he did, right?
My understanding, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to pick the tire up, which is pretty heavy, and I'm going to throw it in. Okay. Didn't do anything, didn't knock it off. Realistically, if you were going to put a tire in a jacked up car, you probably wouldn't throw it in. You'd probably place it in. Nothing. So let me put a little pressure this way. Nothing.
Your difficulty in getting the vehicle to fall down may have resulted in Harold lowering the bottle jack.
Right.
If she was unconscious.
Yeah. And then just knocked it over.
Maybe she was given some kind of narcotic or sedative that made her more malleable in his hands, that he would have been able to physically place her there.
So she would have had to have been in that position regardless.
Correct.
And for some period of time.
Right. Let's try this now.
Lowering the bottle jack.
Oh!
That's it.
That makes a lot more sense. That's something Harold could control.
You can't replicate it the way he says it happened.
Our conclusion is Harold could have actually released that bottle jack, and it could have lowered directly onto her very rapidly. Releasing it down is the most controlled.
We needed to build a history of Harold. We're not proving that Harold killed Lynn, but we wanted to introduce Lynn Henthorne's death into our case of Tony's as a precursor to killing Tony.
This wasn't found out till y'all started your investigation of Tony's death, that his insurance double paid because it was an accident.
Right.
Harold Henthorne had purchased life insurance several months prior to Lynn's death. This policy for $150,000 with a rider on it that if she died in a car accident, it doubled the insurance to $300,000.
When Laura Thomas got our report and finished her investigation, she changed the official cause of death from accidental to indeterminate on the death certificate and reissued that.
What was really important to me was for Lynn's family to know that the death certificate had been changed. So they would know that Lynn was still remembered and that she wasn't forgotten.
I interviewed several women that Harold dated.
Some of these women describe the dates they've been on with Harold, and they range from minorly uncomfortable to, I thought he was going to drive me off the road and kill me. After Lynn's death, Harold wants to marry again. So he does create a profile on ChristianMatchmakers.com. He's saying he wants romance. He's saying he wants eternal love. He's saying he wants a Christian spouse to share his life with.
He's presenting himself as this successful businessman with his own business, resource development services. He's got a business card. He's got notepads with that on it. This persona is far from the truth.
I interviewed several women that Harold dated between Lynn's death and his marriage to Tony. And every one of them said he was super, super controlling.
One of Harold's ex-girlfriends came forward pretty quickly after Tony died saying, this is suspicious. She told us that she knew Harold and Lynn Henthorne and was friends with them. And when Lynn died, she and Harold actually started dating pretty quickly after, within months of Lynn's death. And then Harold started controlling her. She also told us they had an argument and Harold actually pinned her down to a wall until she agreed that he was correct and she was wrong. And she said it scared her. And she decided she wanted to call it off.
One woman he dated said that he left sunglasses somewhere. He said, you go get these sunglasses for me and I'll come pick them up at 8 o'clock. And she went to go get the sunglasses, but the place was closed. She goes to work. Harold calls her and starts yelling at her on the phone. Hangs up and he shows up at her place of business and is badgering her and finally her boss had to get Harold to leave. There's another woman he dated. They go to Estes Park. She says that we're sitting in the Jeep and Harold says, you know, I could kill you and leave you here. No one would find you till springtime. He drove her home. She called him that night and said, I never want to see you ever again. He shows up at her apartment like at 3 a.m. or something. He's banging on the doors and everything.
And some of the women he dates find out pretty quickly that he is extraordinarily focused on their finances and what they make and what sort of families they come from.
He was very interested in how I owned my home. He wanted to know who paid for it, wanted to know if it was my house. And I said, no, it belongs to me, but it also belongs to my mom and my sister. And he was disgruntled by that. He was interested in my job as an attorney, and I don't think he came out and asked about how much money I make, but he was certainly interested in where I worked and how long I had been there. So finances were something that was important to him.
He had these files of these conversations that he had with these women, and he would make notes about the women. And Tony was like, Dr. Mississippi, you know, that kind of thing.
It was Christmas of 1999, and he's like, I want to tell you about somebody. I think I kind of might have met somebody special enough that I'm considering going and meeting her for New Year's.
Tony and Harold meet for the first time in person on New Year's. By that weekend, they've decided to get engaged. Within 9 months, they're married.
And I felt like my relationship with Harold got closer.
After Lynn's death, Harold was actually closer with the Rochelles than he had been before, and particularly with one person.
He stayed very close with Grace Rochelle.
Kevin and I, our marriage, by February 2009, it was done. Harold had a whole list of things he felt like Kevin had failed me emotionally, spiritually, physically, in every way that a man could fail a woman. He was trying to open my eyes to what was really happening in the relationship.
There's several reasons why somebody would kill someone. Another lover, money, did he have a mistress? I had gotten cell records. And one of the individuals that kept popping up in a cell record was Grace Rochelle.
Crazy girl, it is Harold calling you about 3:05.
Harold and Grace texted and called each other all the time before Tony died. And we had to ask the question, was Grace his paramour? Is this why he killed Tony?
This is Deborah Roberts. Harold Henthorne's attorney says the simulation of the car falling off the jack doesn't prove anything. And Henthorne maintains he did not kill either of his wives. Our series was produced by Lone Wolf Media for ABC News Studios. You can catch Episode 3 of Wild Crime, Murder in the Rocky Mountains in the feed next week, or find the series on Hulu. Thanks for listening.